Ecologic.
Hi, this is Jesse Eisenberg. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org.
You don't know what you've got till it's gone. It'd be paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth, tell me where we gonna plant our seed. It makes me wanna cry for the children. Makes me wanna cry for Mother Earth. Makes me wanna cry for we could do. There's so much we could know if we listen to the earth.
Welcome. Glad you could join us for Ecologic. Clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
For Wednesday, July 3rd, 2024.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Today's focus is the Hudson River, from beginning to end, past to present, with our guest, Rick Van Hemmen.
Our news segments cover the importance of conservation funding for farmers and our visit to the Summer of Heat.
Sally and I joined the Gulf South on Friday as part of the Summer of Heat actions. Ken was engineering at the station. The Summer of Heat action last Friday, June 28th, was everything that could have been hoped for. It was well-planned, peaceful, and got good mainstream press. Volunteers were at every intersection to make sure marchers were safe. Actions had permits, police escorts as we marched, and even an officer along the way clapping along to the chants, until I caught her and thanked her. Many people came from all over the U.S., and especially the Gulf South, where fossil fuel extraction is hurting people and the environment. There was a second line march of New Orleans tradition with a great horn section. Arriving at the Citigroup headquarters, those who chose civil disobedience and were okay with getting arrested for their beliefs, for everyone, had a wall of riot-geared police in front and in back of the 68 people who were arrested. Please note, civil disobedience and getting arrested is an option at these events, and there is training to do it right and in accordance with the group's planning. Jail support met at Police Plaza. One thing I really appreciated, just as I first noticed back in Occupy, was a large number of people standing, the young people, standing up for what they believe is the correct way to live and protect their future.
Yeah. We've had programs on the Farm Bill in the past, and it is again, or still, being negotiated. Our agricultural system is extremely vulnerable to the effects of climate change, and the Climate Reality Project has a petition to Congress to ensure that the Farm Bill remains climate-friendly, so that thousands of farmers are not left to fend for themselves against climate change. The conservation portion of the bill has been increasingly important in supporting farmers' and ranchers' efforts to improve soil health, water quality, and resource conservation on private land. Repeatedly, the number of interested farmers far exceeds the available funding. The Inflation Reduction Act helped, the IRA helped somewhat. It produced nearly $20 billion for the Department of Agriculture, USDA, to fund a number of beneficial programs. These include nature-based solutions and climate-smart agricultural practices to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, spur economic growth in rural areas, and increase rural resilience to climate disasters. The USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Services, NRCS, has two main programs, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP, and the Conservation Stewardship Programs. These programs offer direct incentives and no-cost technical assistance, with personalized advice and information based on the latest science and research. Many of the NRCS-approved climate-smart mitigation activities are described as nature-based solutions.
However, there are efforts to reallocate these funds to non-climate-related practices and programs. There is more demand for these programs than there are resources. Assistance must continue to go to climate-smart solutions. The historic investment through the IRA offers a chance to increase program accessibility and benefit the largest number of farmers. Using the Farm Bill to cut IRA funding exacerbates climate risk. We link to information on our site, ecoradio.org. Whatever your thoughts, now is the time to contact your congressional representatives.
Next, Hudson River resident, beloved Dar Williams, sings her tribute to the Hudson River with The Hudson.
If we're lucky, we feel our lives knowing the next scene arrives. So often we start in the middle and work our way out. Goodness, gray sky, done it makes a toast. The New York Times or the New York Post. Then we take a ride through the valley of the shadow of doubt. Camelot in the spring. If you're lucky, you find something that reflects you, helps you feel your life, protects you, cradles you and connects you to everything.
Singing The Hudson.
Now we welcome Rick Van Hemmen. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Rick Van Hemmen. I'm an engineer, but also a very, very committed environmentalist. I've lived in the Hudson estuary for the last 50 years. I was born and raised in the Netherlands and came here when I was 16.
What did you mean by calling the Hudson River a park?
So you're referring to our earlier article I wrote. Well, I find it fascinating that, you know, we think of the Hudson River in many different ways. But the one thing that we don't really, really appreciate is that there are such a tremendous amount of nature and wildlife that's associated with the Hudson estuary and also the upland parts, the drainage of the Hudson. And so, you know, the Hudson starts in the Adirondacks, and that's definitely a park. And from that point on, it starts to flow south, and it passes a tremendous amount of additional parks, and it actually ends, you know, in the Raritan Bay and goes past Sandy Hook and the Gateway National Recreation Area, which is a national park. And it actually, in many ways, flows out into the ocean where you get to the Hudson Canyon, which is going to be a National Marine Sanctuary. So it is just a huge park, and it has wildlife that is truly very, very impressive nowadays. It didn't used to be that way, but it's really becoming a lot more impressive and starting to become closer to what it was, say, 300 years or 400 years ago when Henry Hudson showed up.
Yeah, when you moved here 50 years ago or so, it was a very different situation.
Correct, it was. Actually, it was today it's 49 years and 2 days, right, on July 1st, 1976. So it was a completely different situation. It was a very interesting time because the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts and the various Endangered Species Acts, they were all coming into being, and everybody was trying to figure out how to get this to work. And so when I showed up, you know, New York City was not exactly the most pristine place. It was almost bankrupt. There was trash everywhere, even though there was a July 4th party coming up. But it was it was a big deal. I mean, it was really a mess, is probably the best way to put it. And since that time, I've really enjoyed seeing it getting better and better. And I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's much better than it used to be.
And that's an important point that people don't realize, that the river is something that you can enjoy and wasn't before. Organizations like Clearwater and Riverkeeper and Scenic Hudson started making a difference and bringing attention to the Clean Water Act, to take care of the PCBs. As we know in all of our activism, is nothing happens without activists making a difference, without you, every one of the listeners, speaking up.
Yeah, it takes a village. I mean, it's kind of a silly statement, but in this case, it actually takes a village of about 20 million people. Right. And what I find interesting, too, is that initially it's very difficult to get this moving. But once you get the momentum, it somehow becomes easier. And all I'm saying is somehow it becomes easier because to do the last couple of details also very often ends up being very expensive. So there's some resistance on that, too. I mean, you go for the low-hanging fruit first, right? Don't throw the trash in the river. And then you start to work your way back up the chain and say, well, maybe you should get rid of these PCBs at, you know, some place where it was dumped. And that is expensive, of course. But I really think we're getting to a tipping point where a very large part of our community is realizing that we are looking at a place that is truly special and truly enjoyable and capable of being enjoyed in a way that it wasn't for many, 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 many years.
Now let's go down the Hudson and talk about the wonderfulness of it, because as an environmental show, we often complain that, you know, they're ruining this part of the Hudson, they're ruining that part of the Hudson River shore, but there's so many wonderful things, and I think that we need to keep a perspective why we should worry about when people damage it because of all the greatness that they're damaging.
Right. The Hudson River, we can think of it as a river, but we can think of it as a watershed and estuary too, and the various environmental organizations that describe it in these different segments too. If you just go down the Hudson River, the first thing that strikes you is the emptiness of it. It's very quiet. I mean, I've been up and down the Hudson River on my boat, and in a day I might have seen three or four boats. And yeah, that's sort of off season and not on the weekends, but it is incredibly quiet. Huh. And you get to see a tremendous amount of birds if you pay attention. And at the moment, of course, it's osprey and eagles, which is something that truly didn't exist back in the 70s.
What's an osprey? What's an osprey?
Oh, it's a fish hawk. Osprey is the large. It's a hawk that specializes in catching fish. I mean, some hawks they hunt rabbits, and some hawks hunt squirrels, and these hawks they hunt fish. And their population became decimated because of DDT. contamination. And so in the 70s they were truly endangered, and I remember well that around 1984, where I live south, in Monmouth County, which is which is the most northern part of Jersey Shore, but our watershed is actually into the Raritan Bay, so we're part of the Hudson estuary. But I remember in the early 80s that there was a Coast Guard channel marker that got pushed over at a 45 degree angle by ice, by the river freezing up, which doesn't happen as often anymore, but that was a near annual event.
Wow.
And this channel marker was sitting there kind of cocked over, and all of a sudden an osprey showed up and started building a nest on it. And that nest was there for, almost 20 years. And only in the last decade or so did the channel marker actually fall over. And the funny thing is, you know, this nest had been producing osprey year after year after year. And the funny thing is that when it fell over, people said, oh, we have to put it up again. And then other people said, well, not really, because we have about 30 nests along our river anyway. So there's plenty of space for osprey to do their thing. So these things occur, and it's just a joy. And it really is a joy all along the river. And I'll go even further. When we drive on a turnpike and we drive through the Meadowlands, it looks like a swamp, and it is a swamp. It was actually a tremendous swamp, and it was a day that it was very badly polluted, and today it's much better shape. I mean, there are wildlife viewing areas in the Meadowlands, pretty much right underneath the turnpike.
That's true. I remember when riding through Sea Caucus, it was, very stinky, and it was,
right?
Well, let's go to the northern end of the Hudson, because Donna, Sally, and I, and you live in the lower part of the Hudson River, and we sort of sometimes neglect the northern part. It's not in the listening area of WBAI, but we're live streamed on the internet, so those people are like, "Hey, talk about our part of the Hudson."
Right. It starts Lake Tear to Clouds, which is basically Mount Marcy. So it actually kind of starts at the highest point in New York State, and it drains down. And what a lot of people need to realize too is that the Hudson has its own drainage that goes. It's the Hudson River, obviously, but the interesting part is that the Hudson joins up with the Mohonk River, and the Mohonk River is the river that supplies the water for the functionality of the Erie Canal. And the Hudson River, and I can't remember, I think there's another river, but I can't remember which one it is, provides the functionality of the Lake Champlain Canal. So we actually have a Lake Champlain that is part, more or less part of the Adirondacks, and that connects to the Hudson River. And as a matter of fact, you can go into Canada from there too. And then you have the Adirondacks sitting there where people can go rafting and canoeing down the Hudson River. And then we have the Erie Canal, which is the next section. So it's quite an extensive area.
And you're listening to Ecologic, WBAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Donna Stein.
I'm Sally Gillard.
And I'm Ken Gale.
Now, back to our guest, Rick Van Hemmen. One of our listeners, Judith Weiss from Rutgers University in Newark, points out that the growth of waterfront parks, including restaurants, all around the estuary is amazing. It would have been unthinkable back in the days when the water was stinky and lined with heavy industry and garbage dumps. Rick?
Right. Actually, that's a really nice segue. there is no doubt that people are visually interacting with the river more and more. And so you have waterfront restaurants. And of course, you know, just look at Manhattan, right? The West Side Park is a tremendous park. It really is really cool. What we now have to learn is the next thing is that how do you interact with the river? And I mean, it's these parks that were designed to look at the river, but they haven't really been designed to interact with the river. So we have to learn that. And that interaction is very interesting too, because it could mean, well, we need to have a kayak launch, or maybe we need to have a place where I can tie up a boat for a little bit. But it goes further, because the next thing that's happening is that from a sustainability point of view, water transportation is very efficient. And so what we now are investigating, I'm rather heavily involved in that too, is how can we move cargo again on the Hudson River and all the creeks and byways and all the additional rivers that are there to reduce congestion, road congestion, and to reduce carbon emissions. And that is, again, a thing that where a pig has to go through the python, so to speak, where we have to learn more about how to do that. And it is an incredibly interesting exercise. And at the moment, it's being exercised by the Apollonia Project, which is a schooner that's carrying cargo up and down the Hudson.
And kayaks? I must say that kayaks are the best way to avoid carbon emissions.
Well, yeah, bicycles are good, too. I mean, you know, sailboats are even better because they don't even have to paddle. You move the boat by the wind, right? So that is actually the fascinating part of the whole game, right? I mean, we now have a Hudson River where there's actually long-distance swimming in the river, too. You know, people, there are long-distance swimming clubs in the river. So it gets to be very interesting.
I do kayak swim support for the swims.
Exactly. And the other thing that is very interesting, too, is that not all estuaries are really great for navigation. What is even more remarkable about the Hudson River is that it's a fascinating place to navigate at low speed because it's got all these tidal currents in it. And for example, and I'm not sure if you ever done it, but you can paddle around Manhattan with the tides. You can paddle around, and I've done it. As a matter of fact, I did it with a friend of mine who's a quadriplegic who can paddle with his arms just like he can wheelchair range. And we basically duct taped the paddle to his hands in a double kayak. We went around Manhattan. It was great fun. Wow. That was quite a while ago now. I'd say it was, I'd say, in the late 90s. But even then, already it started looking a lot better.
I do a
circumnavigation like once a year.
Right. And it's fun, right? I mean, you kind of check the tides and you pop in and there you go. And the funny thing is that I have a solar-powered, wheelchair-accessible catamaran. And it's a solar-powered, hybrid-electric, wheelchair-accessible catamaran. I navigate on the tides. It's slow. I mean, if I really go full speed, I can do 7 knots, but I generally run it about 5 knots to combine range with the best possible speed.
And you designed that too, right?
Right, yes. And it was built in the Hudson River too. It was built in Albany by the Scorano. So it's a true Hudson River project. As a matter of fact, I think I had a really interesting historic first. In Kingston, there's a maritime museum, and they have a solar-powered boat too. And we met on the river, and that might be the first meeting between two solar-powered boats on the Hudson River. So we can actually have sort of like a really cool landmark. And that was in 2022.
But so, certainly not the last. Yeah. I hope that there's a listener going, no, I have a solar-powered boat, and I met somebody. It would be great to
I'd love it.
Yeah, right?
I'd love to hear it, because then we will have the first time there will be 3 solar-powered boats that organize that.
And just keep
we
on
need
going.
More of them.
Absolutely.
And the joy of going slow is remarkable. And you know, as a kayak, you know that too, right? I mean, you can stop and kind of look and ponder and but the navigating on the tides was a huge big deal in the development of the economy of the Hudson River. In other words, on the Hudson River, you can move up and down the river even if there's no wind by simply sitting out the tide. You go, take the tide upriver, you anchor, mm-hmm. you wait for the tide to change, and you take the next tide cycle. And that is what Apollonia is doing. Apollonia is a sailing schooner, and they're carrying cargo up and down the Hudson River. And they know they can keep a certain schedule even if the winds are not favorable, because they can keep an eye on the tides and work the tides.
Clever. And that means docks in each town so that they can...
Yes. If you go to their website, you'll see it. I think now they're up into 20 different spots that they've picked up cargo and delivered cargo between Albany and New Jersey. I mean, they've been as far south as Carteret. As a matter of fact, last week, Monday, I helped them load coffee at Carteret in New Jersey, because it was a coffee warehouse that was about a 10-minute drive away from the dock. And Apollonia's rule is that we'll take any cargo, but it has to be zero carbon delivered. So, but they need an EV to carry the coffee from the warehouse in Edison to Carteret, to the waterfront. And I use my Chevy Bolt EV to carry 800 pounds of coffee from the warehouse to the waterfront.
That's great.
And, in our promo, on our website, we promised that we would be talking about economics and history. And certainly the Revolutionary War, the Hudson River, was an incredibly important part of the United States getting independence from England. Battle of Stony Point alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And we always have to remember that we're not just talking about the Hudson River as like this line that goes north-south. It's a whole system. It's an estuary system. Mm. There's a crossing between, well, let's face it, in Staten Island, in the lower corner of Staten Island is Tottenville. And there is a house called the Treaty House there. And that is where Ben Franklin and I think it was John Adams and a couple of other the revolutionaries met with the British authorities to figure out if they could actually shortcut the revolution. And it didn't happen. But then the English, of course, controlled New York City, but all around it there was nothing but upheaval and people, guerrilla warfare and things like that. There were actually pirates in Sandy Hook Bay who actually attacked British ships that anchored there. It was the chain that went across the Hudson at West Point. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on and on.
Oh yeah, that chain is famous. What a brilliant guerrilla warfare that was, to put that chain up, and then all of a sudden the enemy's boats were going up, and it's like, what? I can't go any further on the water.
I've, I don't know for sure how effective the chain was, tell you the truth. It could be more psychological warfare than anything else, where, you know, they said this is it. But if you go past West Point, if you sail a boat, or especially sail a boat, but if you go past West Point, it's very narrow there, and to maneuver through there would be really running gauntlet. So the chain might have been like, let's put an additional obstruction in there. And so when they go through there, it might confuse them, slow them down, and gives us a chance to really pour the lead onto them. You know, it's a high point, so you can fire down into whatever ship comes in, and it's very tight, so it would be very difficult to pass through there.
A lot of towns have one of the links from the chain, and I remember reading somewhere that there are more links that you can see than the actual length of the chain.
That's funny. I don't know if that's true, but I do remember I lived in Newport for a couple of years, and the Redwood Library, which is a wonderful library in Newport, Rhode Island, they had a couple of links out front that are claimed to be from the chain, and I saw a couple of other links somewhere else not too long ago, but I don't remember where it was. But yeah, it's just to forge a chain like that is no minor job either, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, well, there are huge links. I mentioned the Battle of Stony Point, where it may have been Mad Anthony Wayne or Washington. I've read both that they said, "Hey, who here is from the area and can get through the swamp without getting the powder wet?" And they waded through the swamp. They had two guys in charge. And they figured out how to put the British in a crossfire.
Yes.
They got Stony Point and took control of the Hudson River from the British.
And again, all this is, you know, New Jersey really was the battleground of the Revolution. And a lot of people don't realize that. But there's also a Battle of Monmouth. And that actually took place on June 28th. So, again, it's, you know, kind of an anniversary, but that was an interesting case too, where the colonials chased the British, hoping to set them up for a battle, and the British became annoyed and they turned around at Freehold, New Jersey, and they faced them, and it became an artillery battle. And there was a guy who was in George Washington's army who actually had his farm where the battle was. And he goes to his commanding officer and says, you know, I know how to get guns on a high hill here. And so they went to George Washington and said, bring these guns up. And the battle was won simply by local knowledge. They got the guns on a high hill and raked the British line. And the British said, yeah, we got enough, we're leaving. You know, local knowledge is everything. And the same thing goes for people that live along the Hudson River. You know, you build up local knowledge and you get benefits out of it.
Yeah, I remember being part of the community advisory group for the Rebuild the Meadowlands, the New Meadowlands Rebuild by Design program after Sandy. And, you know, AECOM and all those guys are like, tell us where the problems are. You guys have the local knowledge.
You'd be surprised, too. It is. And it's really fun. And for me, it's really fun, too, when I travel up and down the Hudson to actually meet up with people, because the Hudson is a little different from many other rivers. It's the Hudson River itself is very deep and massive, but the creeks that go in it are inherently quite small. And so very often you run by a creek and you go, can I actually go in there? Is there actually anything there? And I must say that I haven't explored, but maybe five or six of the creeks. And I know there's dozens more, and that'd be really fun to go into also to see what's going on.
And I'd like to know how many of those are clean and how many of those are polluted.
Right. They're pretty good, though. I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, they're pretty good. I'm not aware of any creeks that spew problems on a regular basis. I mean, we still have things to do. I mean, we still have to deal with the overflow discharges from excessive rain. And that has to be dealt with. The good thing about that, and if there's anything good about it, there's nothing worse than continuous pollution, stuff that runs in continually. I mean, that's just horrible. If you have event pollutions, it's more easy to deal with. You say, okay, mm-hmm. It happened, but now we can go past it. And That happens, you know, worldwide. I mean, if you have continuous oil running into a certain river, it gets ruined. If there's an oil spill, it's bad. But yeah. Science shows that the recovery is possible.
Now we're getting into the problems with the CSOs and how maybe that's not a continually daily problem, but it is an infrastructure problem that has to be solved probably in every major city.
That goes back to the low-hanging fruit line, right? I mean, you do the things that you can fix, and then you have to deal with the very difficult ones. And in New York City, it is a complex issue. It's solvable, but it's a complex issue.
I like what you were talking about bringing the coffee in your Bolt card to a community. We're touching on the economics of commerce on the Hudson. Before there were roads, before you could travel with your Bolt to deliver the coffee, the only way to get products, commodities up and down the Hudson was in sloops like the Clearwater, which is why Pete Seeger built the Clearwater to illustrate how commerce did work many, many years ago. We no longer need boats to bring things to the towns, but it's really important for people to know.
We don't need them, but if we could use them in a local, you know, small scale way to take some of the pressure off the roads, and you know, could be a good thing, like Bologna is doing.
I like charm, but I'm not a romantic. Is probably the best way to put it. This thing that Apollonia is doing is very interesting because it's refocusing river trade. They're bringing small cargoes that are not necessarily economical, but they're bringing them to the waterfront. People show up at the waterfront, and they are then happy to get involved in what's taking place on the waterfront, and it increases exposure. Hopefully, eventually, we'll do this economically.
Cool. Now, we'll be back with our guest in just a few minutes. WBAI is one place you can go to hear the voices of the people, listener-supported radio. There are many viewpoints. We bring you discussion and experts that you won't hear anywhere else, at least not in depth. This is your media. Sure, we ask for your donations. Isn't that better than when media companies take their dollars from influencers with corporate money? Yep, we think so too. So please be generous with your support. Whether you request a thank you gift or join us as an Ecologic BAI buddy, it all works to keep your radio station on the air. We appreciate all our listeners, and we appreciate when you show us that you want us to stay on the air.
Just as change doesn't happen unless activists take steps to make it happen, media doesn't just stay on the air without your action either. In this case, your financial support. Please go to give2wbai.org to make your donation, or you can send a check or money order.
And to let us know you are a listener, we'd love for you to go to our website, ecoradio.org, and sign up for our email list. You'll be sure to hear of upcoming shows.
We appreciate your belief in the power of grassroots media and this radio show. Your contribution helps to help us go forward. We are particularly grateful to our Ecologic BAI buddies who help ensure that the station's bills get paid every month. Please donate now so you can be proud of having done your part to keep Ecologic and BAI on the air.
Your donations help to ensure that our transmission tower rent is paid so that our on-the-air broadcast is uninterrupted. Every dollar you contribute goes directly towards sustaining independent journalism, empowering grassroots initiatives, and fostering a sense of belonging in our community. Together, we can make a difference through the power of community radio. Please support WBAI. Go to give2wbai.org.
WBAI's rich wealth of unique, insightful, informative, and entertaining programming allows you to enjoy public affairs shows, art shows, health and science shows. 168 hours for you each week. You'll hear voices on WBAI that are left out of mainstream media. Please do your part to help us bring you incredible programming. Go to give2wbai.org to make your donation, or you can send us a check or money order.
When you choose to become our Ecologic BAI buddy, you are giving us a reliable source of support that we can depend on, just as you can depend on WBAI-FM. We're here for you all the time, and you'll be helping to ensure that we stay here. Just $10 or $15 a month, more if you can, enables people to listen wherever they are.
When you donate, please let us know if we can thank you on air. We appreciate all our listeners, and we'll thank you publicly, if you'd like, as soon as we can.
You're listening to Ecologic, BAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Donna Stein.
I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Sally Gellert.
Now we continue with Rick.
Rick, tell us a little bit about the Navesink Maritime Heritage Association.
Right. So in 1999, a friend of mine named Charles Ladulis, we were both members of a boat club, said, you know, why don't we have a little community boat building event? Decided to have an event, and he built something called six-hour canoes. And they are canoes that you cannot build in 6 hours. You actually build them in a weekend. But they're made out of two sheets of plywood and a bunch of sticks, and they're very capable canoes. And we built those, and we said, this is fun to do. Let's start an organization, and we called it Navesink Maritime Heritage Association. And we have a motto that is discover, engage, and sustain. And that really means that, again, maritime can be ignored too easily. And what we do is kind of draw attention to maritime. And in our area, Monmouth County, for example, waterfront access was a big deal. We had a real sense it was hard and harder for people to get their kayaks in the water. So we pushed for that. And we are involved with environmental quality, with water quality. And we still built canoes. And when you started building these canoes and realized that they weren't used enough, and we started a program called River Rangers, where we actually take kids on the river for a week, where they go each day, they go to a different part of the river. And that program will start the week after next again. We've run it since 2005, so it's 20 summers. We've had hundreds of kids going through it. And they use the canoes that we built, and the canoes are painted, and the kids can paint them any way they want to. We have some that are painted like a New York City taxi cab, and others that are painted like a crocodile or something, and have different paint jobs on them. And they go out, and they paddle the river, and it's very cathartic because we take a drag net, and they can see what is in the river. There have been years that they actually have paddled along dolphins and stuff. And so it's a really neat program. I think the biggest reaction that we've had, though, is that we launched the canoes in one place, and we pull ashore, and we walk through the local ice cream store, and the kids go, you mean you can go to the ice cream store by the water? They just kind of find a new way to look at the world, too, and that's a very important thing.
That's cool. It reminds me of the Clearwater education trips where they also pull nets of things up.
Sally, we're always on the same track. Part of the environmental school classroom on the Clearwater is always bringing up life from the river and putting in a tank just for the time of the sale, and showing all the kids what's in the river. There's seahorses in the river.
For us, we kind of live at the river, but I find that whenever I take any person, adult or kid, on the river the first time, that it is very cathartic. I mean, it's a very strange experience to them. It's a big leap. I mean, and the trick, of course, is to get that big leap started, but then to keep reinforcing it. I mean, a classic sales pitch is, right, you can't sell anything until you've touched customers seven times. Mm-hmm. And that is really the most difficult thing to do. In Navesink Maritime, that's part of the sustained thing too. We try to run programs that people are aware they occur and they come back, and we try to have a little bit of a growth arc too, where we touch the kids young, and then we try to keep programs that kind of go on.
How does the kid get on the river through you?
No, sign up. Just go to the website, navasinkmaritime.org, and you can sign up for the River Rangers. I think there's still a couple spots open. And there are other programs too. I mean, and the other thing, of course, we do too is we work with, and I like that a lot, actually. We work with commercial entities like Sea Streak in their efforts too. Sea Streak used to be a ferry service, but a significant part of their business now is whale watching and trips up the Hudson River. And as Navasink Maritime, we will say, hey, we're going to do Sea Streak is going to do the first trip around Staten Island. Navasink Maritime is doing research on the narration of it. Come on the first trip and be the experimental people that are going around Staten Island, where we explain everything about Staten Island. And for example, when we did that, I narrated what we had so far, and it was hilarious to be there because a lot of people knew much more about it than I did. They had huge arguments as to what we were looking at the shore or not. And it was a really fun trip.
No, sounds great, yeah.
Is that only Lower Hudson, or is that the whole river?
No, Sea Streak stops pretty much at a little north of West Point. There's a certain amount of time that they can run, that they can do a trip in. It's a distance issue and a speed issue. Mm-hmm. It'd be fun to start thinking now in terms of these excursion vessels that are more sustainably powered. And we have a proposal to do a replica paddle wheeler, side wheeler, for the Hudson River that is mostly solar powered. It's hybrid, but it's mostly solar and shore-based electric powered. And that boat will be slower, but it'll be very comfortable. And keep in mind that the best part about electric boats is they're silent. They're absolutely silent. I mean, you hear the birds when you're running on an electric boat. It's like being on a kayak. It's amazing.
I remember my grandfather's boat, which we would never go on very often, but it was loud. It'd be really nice to have a quiet trip.
How long do these trips take?
Talk about the Sea Streak trips, or are you talking about my trips up and down the river?
Your trips.
Oh, okay. Well, if I run through the night, I can get my boat from Albany to Red Bank, which is all the way in the Jersey Shore, in 24 hours. Many times I do it slower. I go up the river and take 3 days, 4 days, and I go up the Erie Canal, and I've been to Lake Champlain too.
Yeah. I remember back, I guess, in the 80s, Richard Robbins' sailboat was running weekend excursions, and we would get on the boat on Friday night and go up to Bear Mountain and come back by Sunday afternoon.
That's a good trip. Yeah, that's a nice trip.
It really was, yep.
Yep.
When you said Lake Champlain, where's that?
Well, Lake Champlain divides Vermont from New York State.
So between Vermont and New York, it's up there.
I'm sorry?
Lake Champlain is the border of Vermont and New York, right?
Correct, yeah. It's 100 miles, if not longer. There have been naval battles on Lake Champlain.
Yeah.
It is very much part of the... Was a strategic corridor during the Revolutionary War, too. In other words, the British thought if they could control Champlain, the Hudson River, and New York, they would split the colonies and therefore get more control, and they never really pulled that off. They couldn't quite get that to work.
Yeah.
Lake Champlain, I consider to be, and I've been sailed a lot of lakes and a lot of oceans and places, but Lake Champlain is really a wonderful lake to sail on. I mean, I take my solar power boat on there, but I'm there licking my chops going, wow, I wish I had a sailboat. You go just take very relaxing sails on somewhat larger water. It's a beautiful lake. Beautiful.
And I think it's big enough where there are tides, and it's not just like a small lake.
No, not really, but you get things like wind tides. So the wind really blows down from the north to the south, to the south to the north. The water shifts, but it's not like the Great Lakes, which still have some tides, but Lake Champlain not so much. But it can really cook up. I mean, when the wind really blows strongly from the north to the south, I mean, it gets choppy, I mean, it really gets choppy. But that kind of makes it fun. The variety of it makes it a really fun lake to sail.
There's a lot of variety to this Hudson River ecosystem that we're talking about. And luckily, there's a lot of ways to experience it.
And more to come. More to come, hopefully. And you're absolutely right. It is. I like to think of this. You know, there's people that go, oh, we're going to Africa, to Serengeti, and we're going to see whale, elephants and lions and zebras and stuff. You say, that's nice. Okay, you get on the plane, you fly out there. They take you around on some kind of tourist truck and say, oh, look, there are the tourist lions and there are the tourist zebras. Well, the funny thing is we're sitting in a park that is much bigger and it has much more interesting wildlife because the whales, they, when you go see the whales, they are wild, okay? They're not tourist elephants. They're really wild. And when we have and they're free, too. In other words, you know, even in Africa now, a lot of this wildlife is constrained. I mean, it can't really move the way it used to move. But our wildlife, especially the maritime wildlife, of course, is incredibly free. So I, the one thing I'd like to advocate for is getting wolves back here.
So in our and we're about ready to wrap up. And one thing we always do is we ask our what can our listeners do? In this case, is how can our listeners be more involved with the river? So why don't you...
What can our listeners do? I'll tell you what our listeners can do. Watch Anthony Bourdain's episode on the Hudson River. He nailed it. If you go watch Anthony Bourdain's episode on the Hudson River, he absolutely nails it. It is stunning. It's really fun to watch.
Well, thank you very much. And it is time to wrap up. Boy, does the time fly.
Yeah,
so right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Thanks to our guest, Rick Van Hemmen. For more information, go to www.navisincmaritime.org. That's NAVISINKMARITIME.org. As always, if you'd like a follow-up or news report on any environmental topic or our previous shows or news items, email us using the clickable link near the top of the page, just under the promo meme, ecoradio.org. And please go to give to WBAI.org to become a BAI buddy in the name of Ecologic, or make a donation.
Join us next Wednesday, July 10th at 10 a.m. We talk about green jobs. We love to stay in touch with you. So those of you online, please sign up for our email list or like our Facebook page. We are WBAI Ecologic, no dashes.
Unlike most radio stations, WBAI welcomes you to get involved. Our meetings are open to the public, and you can find details on the meeting section of the WBAI.org homepage. And, of course, we always need your contributions to support everything that makes the broadcast happen. And don't forget Bob Henley at noon. Please become our buddy today.
We're sure you'll see the value of Ecologic and WBAI and support us. Ecologic covers many issues. Take a look at our website, ecoradio.org, to see just how many. Donating to WBAI in the name of Ecologic is supporting many groups. They all have a voice here.
Thanks in advance for your support. You can donate online by going to give2wbai.org. If you prefer, you can send a check or money order for your membership and or donation. Mail to WBAI Radio, Attention Membership, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. That's 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, 11217.
We're always glad to have you with us for Ecologic, live or on the archives. This show will be on the WBAI archive in just 5 or 10 minutes. I'm Sally Gellert.
I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. Our thanks to our engineer and co-host, Ken Gale. We certainly couldn't do this without you on any level. Join us on Wednesday, July 10th at 10 a.m. We're usually here Wednesdays at 10 a.m. between the excellent programs Covert Action Bulletin and Living for the City. Check our website for updates. Thank you for being our listeners.
See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth.
So energy soul.
Give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady glow of waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things as they return to wind. Give me the restless power of the wind. Give me the comforting flow of the wind.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I think it's all right.
Frogs eating the flies.
Yep, then off to the neighbors to watch the paint dry.
Mr. Wilson, Mr. Wilson, the trains are coming, the trains are coming.
Land sakes, it's the Arts Express pulling into the station with goodies for all of us.
Oh, well, it's about time. Looky, there's presents for everyone.
Look, Pa, it's a preview of the latest indie feature.
And more, it's an interview with a major Broadway theater actor.
And I got some shiny new film reviews from film festivals all over the world.
And here's cutting-edge poetry from the country's most progressive poet.
Oh, sweet Lord, it's a miracle.
No, it's not. It's Arts Express with host Prairie Miller.
That's Arts Express with host Prairie Miller at our new day and time, Wednesdays at 9 p.m., on WBAI, New York.
Tune in at 7 a.m. to noon on July 4th for the rebroadcast of the June 29th Mass Poor People's and Low Wage Workers Assembly and Morale March on Washington and to the polls. You'll hear remarks by Reverend Dr. William Barber and Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, as well as other activists around the country working to engage America's 85 million low-wage and low-wealth voters, fully a third of the American electorate. The June 29th coverage is all part of Pacifica's We Decide America at the Crossroads 2024 that will include coverage of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee from July 15th to the 18th and the Democratic National Convention in Chicago from August 19th to the 22nd. The 53rd Annual International African Arts Festival is set to take place at Commodore Barry Park in Brooklyn from July 4th to July 7th. This highly anticipated event celebrates the rich diversity and excellence of African culture through a vibrant showcase of arts, fashion, music, dance, and more. From a dedicated children's play zone to captivating poetry shows, fashion, and natural hair shows, and chess tournaments, there is something for everyone at this year's festival. The International African Arts Festival will take place at Commodore Barry Park, bordered at Navy Street, Park, and Flushing Avenues from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., rain or shine. For more information about the International African Arts Festival, please visit iaafestival.org. That's iaafestival.org.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
Hi, this is Joe Summer, and you're listening to WBAI, and it's all mixed up, and it's mixed in, too.
Okay.
And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. Coming up next is Living for the City with Michael G. Haskins. And then at noon, Bob Henley.